You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real-life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
So we're living dangerously, Tim of the Keen and I, on a podcast, recording it for all to see. Yes, for both of our listeners can watch this now. So Tim's a bit of a marketing chap. I think, is that one way of describing it?
Yeah, you can put it like that. Yeah.
With a bit of e-commerce, and you know about e-commerce and computers and the internet and stuff.
Mm-hmm. I do think that's a good way of putting it.
People have heard of the internet. Yes. I mean, there's this fantastic summary. Tim learned the ropes by dropshipping sex toys and bootleg Harry Potter merchandise. Now, you wrote this and you sent this out.
Yes.
Which is brilliant. And you started out life in Melbourne in Australia, which I'm going to pronounce Melbourne, just to annoy you. And then you spent some time in Montreal, which must have been fantastique. You see what I did there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. French. Very French.
And it's the rock band stuff. And of course, you landed in Los Angeles. Where else?
Where else? Exactly. Where all misfits, all Australian misfits end up.
So I don't want to hear anything about the e-commerce thing. It's Harry Potter merchandise. That's what I really want to do. I suppose drop shipping sex toys, is that because you wanted to get into a horizontal industry as opposed to a vertical industry?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, I think it depends on who you ask, whether it's a horizontal. Depends on the timing, really, whether it's a horizontal.
I mean, it must have been fantastic in terms of the numbers of jokes and ribald humor that you can generate when people say, what do you do? You say, I drop ship sex toys. I mean,
well, I didn't tell it. I refused to tell anyone for a long time because it's much more embarrassing when you're not successful yet. Now that I've been able to kind of finagle it into a real career, it's a great story.
But oh, you'll never guess how I started. Yes.
But when you're desperately trying to make it work, it's not that fun. It's not that funny to tell people about it.
And also the selection process in terms of what I'm going to put. I'm just going to focus on this for a bit because, as I said, it's your fault. You wrote it down there. Mm-hmm. But, and this bears testament to just business generally. So you think, right, okay, this is a niche. So I'm going to go into this area here. You start choosing your products, presumably based on a little bit of market research. But I suppose you've got to be pretty, you can't just go on your own sample of one thing. You've got to do research to actually find out what works in that space.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I really did fall into it. I was just looking for products to sell. I had no experience. I'd never transacted online before. So I, first of all, kind of proved the concept with Harry Potter merchandise, which someone else was selling. And I was just like, okay, I'm going to get this to work. And then it's kind of like when you're like looking for a new car. And then, you know, when you're in the market for a new car and you see cars everywhere and you're like, oh yeah, that's a great car. When you're in the market for a product, when you're just kind of clicking around the internet and like you're clicking on AliExpress, you're just around, you fall on products and you're like, oh, that's a good product. And I fell onto some website that had figured out how to rank just incredibly well for all the terms that they were selling for. And I did some quick math and they must have been doing like 100,000 searches a month. And this website looked terrible. It looked like it was made by a teenager in like 20 minutes. And I was like, okay, here we go. The thing that's keeping people out of this market is that it's embarrassing and silly and funny.
Yeah.
And if I'm willing to do that, then I have less competition on the other end. So it turned out to be true.
And again, that is a very interesting thing because those types of markets, there is so much preconception or there is so much me too in e-commerce, which is, I think, your area of expertise, where received wisdom, for example. So this company's doing it this way, so I'm going to do it that way. And what's interesting about what you did with the first venture is that you applied sort of scientific research and said, well, you know, which areas are underserved? Where can I probably create momentum if I can do a much better job at marketing? And is that really the beginnings or is that the genesis, I suppose, of where you thought, hang on, if I can be successful with this, these are transferable. We can start building a business out of that.
Yeah, I do think it was. So I was very adamantly kind of optimizing for learning as opposed to like profit. mostly because it's so difficult to make a profit dropshipping, like a real profit. Like the margins are not there. You're just a middleman. Like it's really borderline impossible. And what you realize quickly is that, oh, okay, this skill is transferable. There are a lot of different ways. If you can figure out how to make money or how to generate revenue, that skill is eminently transferable and everyone's looking for that. And so the specifics of the object are not that relevant. But I think to your point, it did really give. So after I learned how to do that, I think a lot of my success has really come from finding things that are underserved, whether that's like I learned Google ads as opposed to Facebook ads, because I knew that less people were experts in Google ads. And so there was more opportunity to get really good at it. And that played in my interest as well. And I'll test ad formats that I know a lot of people aren't using, or different ways of presenting information that are just, there's just a little more pain up front. If there's a little more pain up front to get into that particular area, it's typically easier on the other side. And we're seeing it now, even in e-com, alcohol is booming right now. Massive, massive growth. D2C, direct-to-consumer alcohol, is a massive growth vertical online. And one of the reasons why it's flourishing is because it's difficult to get that license. You have to figure out how to legally ship alcohol around, and that alone puts enough people off that there's an open field still.
Your clients, so tell me about how Loop Club came about.
So I was working at Meet6, which is a really large digital agency, a fast-growing digital agency, and they sold to Dentsu, as you do. And we just kind of didn't want to go and work for Dentsu. And I like wanted to try something else. I love Meet6. Like I learned a lot from there. But I went to a different agency. I went in-house. But then the pandemic started and our clients were just hitting us up. Like all of a sudden, e-commerce grew. E-commerce grew as much in, I think, 3 months as it did in the previous 10 years. So anyone who had touched e-commerce before was suddenly just like, can you do this? Can you do this? And so my experience has been, I literally just sat down at my computer in March 2020, and I haven't really stood up yet. I've just been working, and the volume just keeps coming and coming and coming. So some clients came with me. We'd already seen success with some clients, and they came with me. And then it started coming through word of mouth and just people who knew people. And then it's really started growing from there.
Yeah. So in terms of the specialist skills, so as a company that's looking to grow their customer base, we talk about e-com and your specialist skills, which is working with, Shopify and those types of apps. But does your company provide solutions to businesses that are just looking generally to grow their customer base? They may not have an e-com platform. They may not be transacting direct to consumer. They may be looking to grow their customer base generally. Are those types of skills or learnings transferable to those businesses?
I would say yes and no. There is something pretty magical about e-com because you get a very direct feedback loop between what you do and then the results. You can very quickly see how much revenue your activity is driving. And that's not necessarily true with offline businesses or lead generation businesses. But I would say the fundamental skills of like how to set up an ad account, how to understand a value proposition, how to make creative that works, all of that kind of stuff is very much transferable. But we really work with people who are advertising online and who are looking to transact online.
And again, in terms of, you know, particular success stories, what are the areas where you've worked with businesses where it surprised you how much growth you can generate? And obviously it surprised the owners of the business.
There's a couple of really, really crazy ones. So the first one that was a relatively like life-changing one for me, where I was like, oh wow, you can really juice this, was a company called Trophy Skin. And they are a skincare brand. It was like a nice like microdermabrasion company. So it's like a big kind of expensive object that you use to like wash the skin off your face, makes you look younger. And I built a YouTube ad for them, which I'd never really done. I'd done it once before to middling success. And I built a really nice landing page running all the principles that I knew worked. And we took the business from a $40,000 a month business to a $1.2 million a month business in about 5 months. And then they sold the business straight away. So that was really the genesis of like, wow, if you get everything working, it is so, so, so scalable. Now that kind of success doesn't happen all the time. That's like, you need a lot of things to line up for that. But once you understand how to play with those levers, it gets easier.
And what are the biggest sort of mistakes you think that you come across when you work with companies that have tried to do this themselves?
So I think there's two kinds of mistakes that I see. There's companies that try to do it themselves, and there's companies that try to work with agencies and fail. And they both fail a lot of the time. So when you look at companies who are trying to do it themselves, there are, again, like I said, a lot of barriers to entry. I always describe these ad accounts as kind of like casinos. Google and Facebook ads are like casinos in that if you don't know what you're doing, if you're not an expert card counter, they're designed to take your money off you.
Yeah.
So there's, if you were to go into Google Ads right now and build an account and set everything up so it looked technically correct and you did everything that Google said, you would waste thousands and thousands of dollars. Undoubtedly, inevitably, because it's designed for you to do that.
Yeah.
So people make very fundamental mistakes that the only way to not make them is through having had the experience of spending that amount of money before or seeing a lot of accounts. So there's really basic stuff, buttons that you need to press on, things that you need to switch off. I would say that's what I see from in-house accounts, people who've been trying to do it themselves. But another one that we see all the time, and I mean every single day, is agencies who have failed in accounts, agencies who have misrepresented what they'll do or not actually known how to do the job or not delivered. Everyone has an agency horror story.
Is it just the technical setup or is it just how important is content? How important is targeting in e-com business? And I know I don't want you to give away the secret sauce, as it were, but you know, what are the areas where people fail most often? Is it you know, creating content that really does not engage people?
Oh, I'll give it away. We give it away all the time. And the reason why is because it's still pretty hard to execute. Executing is really where the devil is, and there's a lot of details. So everyone in e-com thinks that the secret lies somewhere in the ad platform. If you go in there and you tweak the right knobs and you press the right buttons, all of a sudden you'll make millions of dollars. And the product and the website and the how you put it across, that takes second priority in a lot of people's minds. And that is, it's backwards. It's completely backwards. And I think you hit it right on the nail right on the head just before, which is that the content and the offer and the value proposition is 80% of the work. Have you made something that is compelling to people, is genuinely useful to people? And how simply have you explained the value that the person is going to get from that product? And usually people haven't. They haven't explained it.
And how much do you think the fact that you are not a sort of dyed-in-the-wool marketer out of university, that you've sort of, I wouldn't say fallen into this because that doesn't, you know, sort of describe what you've done properly, but you probably never saw yourself a couple of years ago doing what you're doing today. And how much of that outsider's experience has given you the ability to look at the way that e-com marketing has been structured and see gaps that people within the industry have been blinded to?
It's really, really helpful. I mean, we would see it all the time at my previous agency, and we still see it, which is that people who go the business school route and then try to apply business school learnings to e-commerce frequently don't succeed. Whereas the people who are really doing well, who are really driving growth, come from weird backgrounds or come from outside the industry or have had some sort of entrepreneurial experience. We see that consistently. I think it's what has helped me a lot is, one, like, I'm a pretty clear writer. I have a good amount of experience with writing, and I can write pretty compelling, clear, easy to understand copy. I would say that's like a very large amount of it. I would say that's like 40 to 50% of it. I'd say there's another, and then the next 50% is really split between two other categories of things, which I just happen to have good experience with. One is being relatively good at understanding data, but not necessarily at a really high level. Like, you don't need to be a data scientist. You don't need to be able to like do really complex stuff. You just need to have a comfort and understanding of like reading a graph and what it means and being able to act on that information.
And using those skills, I mean, and you mentioned earlier that earlier this year, when the pandemic really took hold, you saw something again that most people weren't expecting, which was that huge upswing in a number of areas, you know, e-commerce and online transactions. Do you think that's sustainable? But most importantly, do you think that customer behaviors have changed over the last 18 months in a permanent way? And let's answer that. Let's get your views on that first, and then I've got a follow-on question.
Yeah, there's a few different things that I think will happen. One is that we are seeing a certain segment of customers that purchased during COVID who we have not been able to bring back to people's online stores. It's definitively happened. There's a lot of people who were like panic buying, or their purchasing behavior changed at the start of the pandemic, and they don't have repeat purchase behavior. They've gone back to their previous way of shopping. That is true. On the other hand, the whole industry has grown so much that there is still more volume. There's still a lot of people shopping online. But the additional complication, the extra wrinkle here, is the increase in advertising costs, which is all that anyone's talking about right now. Advertising is becoming harder, less targeted, more expensive. And while there are more people shopping online, the cost of acquiring a new customer is rising. So what we are starting to see is a little bit of a shakeout and consolidation. The private equity companies and holding companies are starting to buy and consolidate successful brands. If you are an e-commerce seller and you have low margins or a low average order value or a low conversion rate, you are in trouble. You're having a harder time than you might have previously been. There is a bit of a shakeout happening in the industry, certainly.
And the cost of advertising has increased. Is that because of the amount of competition that's pushing the bids up for? Because I think you talk about the fact that you've bought, is it $100 million worth of advertising, something like
that? Yeah, between our team, easily.
Which is quite a lot. So you're seeing big spends, you know, presumably these are tens of thousands of dollars a day with some of these clients. And are they getting a commensurate turn, increase in return, or is it getting to the point where the publishers, you know, the Googles and the Facebooks, are really just trying to take advantage of this situation?
I mean, Google and Facebook are built to take advantage of all situations, and they're machines that take advantage of the situation. And Facebook is, Apple has kind of reached into the fray and made it a little more difficult to target on Facebook, which is raising advertising costs. Increased competition is raising costs. Google and Facebook would claim that they're just running an auction, right? They claim that they're kind of neutral arbiter and people are bidding for attention, but that's obviously not true. And they manipulate the auction a variety of ways in their interest. But what I would say is if you think about an advertiser who's spending $10,000 a day, they know what they're doing. They're running a very serious and sophisticated program, and they have multiple channels working, and they're looking at the overall blended results of their advertising on the business, not just one channel. They're thinking about, okay, how did our overall expenditure work over the course of the last month when we look at our total net new customers compared to our total media expenditure? If you're a small business and you only have 10 grand a month to spend, it's much harder out there. I think it's what's become harder is not really growing an established brand. I think it's still possible. It's the first 20 grand in spend. Launching a new brand is getting harder for sure.
Yes, and there are new platforms. I mean, we know TikTok, for example, but also there are other more established platforms that are changing the way that they interact with their customer bases. Are you seeing any likely sea changes, significant changes in the way these platforms are going to engage their customers as a result of, you know, this change in dynamics?
Definitely. So the thing to watch out for, I mean, TikTok is growing extremely, extremely quickly. We're starting to pay pretty serious attention to it, and we feel like we're late to the game. There's some real attention to be had on TikTok. And one thing that you have to look at on TikTok is the engagement rate. So the percentage of people who follow a given person who actively engage with that person. And it's very, very, very high. I think it's like 11% or something compared to less than 1% on Instagram. It's astronomically high. And TikTok is introducing shopping features within the app quite soon. They're doing a native integration with Shopify. So TikTok people will be able to have storefronts essentially like within the app. And we are seeing in the industry, one of the easiest ways to launch a brand is to have a platform already, right? If you have a media arm or if you have a lot of followers, you have a massive advantage in launching a brand. So I think that trend will continue. We are already, even just from my little side of the world, we're starting to see a lot more brands launch that are venture-backed brands that are formed around an influencer or a specific person with reach. I think that will continue. And I think we'll see a lot more of that start to play out when big accounts on most social media platforms start to monetize. But that's one thing to watch out for. And the other thing to watch out for is Facebook, Google, Shopify, and TikTok's direct integrations with Shopify. So they're starting to pass data as a workaround to Apple, as passing data all between themselves. And it's going to be very, very clean native integrations between Facebook, Google, TikTok, and Shopify, which creates a little bit of a data ecosystem, which is really interesting. It's something to watch.
And how important do you think influencer marketing will be in the near term? So is influencer marketing, I know you mentioned that just now, that it's important that people have some sort of following to give them that that springboard. But do you think influencer marketing is something that is a fad Is it something that's here to stay? Is that a separate growth industry in its own right?
I think it's a complicated question. People buy from people, and they always have. So if you're able to put a face on a product and have someone saying, like, this is the thing, it worked for me, I'll stake my reputation on it, it will, that works, and that will continue to work. The way that influencer marketing is kind of a broken industry, it's a very time-consuming thing to do. It's just a lot of like reaching out to people, talking to them. That being kind of those mid-level content creators is a really, like, it's not quite a value proposition that works for every side. So again, I think there'll be a shakeout and a streamlinedness in terms of how the industry actually works. But I don't think spokespeople and celebrities building products is going anywhere. I think that's going to grow and grow and grow.
And of course, also funny enough, I was talking to someone the other day that specializes in providing video content, personalized video content. And his view, which I think is interesting and valid, and is that there is a move towards rehumanizing the internet, which is his expression, where everything has been, you know, metrics and automation has been relied on sort of to date. But is there a market that's untouched where that sort of personal touch, in other words, where the shop owner is in contact with the potential customer through some sort of medium? And this is a, you know, I think you've probably already answered when we talked about influencer marketing, but is there a move that you're seeing towards more direct contact between the shop, the people behind the shop or the store, and their customers?
Absolutely. If you think about the growth of live shopping, which is something that we haven't really, we're not really in that as an agency, but we're seeing it grow a lot, which is when people host Instagram events or on third-party platforms, and they like sell stuff on Instagram. They just like go through a bunch of stuff. People like decide to buy it. These live shopping events, they're really big in China. They're growing in the US. And I do think that you've hit the nail on the head, which is that like now we live in this post-COVID world where we're used to Zooming with people all the time, but we're also used to connecting with directly with people over Zoom and over video. And we're used to getting that kind of personalization. And I do think that's something that people are starting to expect more and more, especially as we continue in COVID, and COVID doesn't seem to be ending anytime soon. So I do think that, I mean, it's still metric driven, it's still KPI driven, but it is leveraging the specific personality of the store owner or of the merchant a little bit more. I agree.
I think because from an agency perspective, you're always looking for that angle. You're looking for that unexplored sort of seam of gold that's going to connect you. So it'd be interesting. And I think what you said is, again, is important, that people now are much more used to interacting with other people online. Whereas, you know, a couple of years ago, Zoom was something that few people had heard of. Now it's something that's in part of the everyday vernacular. So again, I'll be interesting to see from your point, and I think you just answered it, but is that a major area of growth, do you think? So are you seeing it real growth in that area, or are we just hoping that area will grow? This idea of individual contacts of perhaps, you know, people hosting. I know you talk about sort of sales parties in China, but are you seeing that coming over here, do you think?
I think it's possible. I mean, I think America, there's still advantages to having a kind of automation and scale behind it. But I think the fundamental principle is that people really respond to a sales pitch. They really, really, really do. And there's no one who can sell like the founder of a company. If you started a company, you are typically the company's best salesperson. And if you are in the blessed, fortunate position of being an articulate and camera-ready founder of an e-commerce startup, there's nothing better you could do for your business than like get on camera and talk right into it. Like it just works. It works so, so, so well.
Yes. And is that something that you've recently discovered, or has that been a truth all the way through, do you think, but just not, hasn't been mined?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's been true forever. I think if you look at the history of American capitalism, it's sales. It's the sales letter. It's door-to-door salespeople. It's someone like showing up and being like, let me show you what this can do. Here are the benefits. Like, I'm going to like cut through your objections. And then there's an audience, a receptive audience listening to that sales pitch. I think that is, it's so deeply ingrained in this culture, but where I think it isn't universally adopted in the industry. And I think we see these breakout successes when a product manages to do it. Dr. Squatch is a really good example. So Dr. Squatch is a soap brand that scaled on YouTube. They scaled from about $5 million in annual revenue to about $100 million in annual revenue in, I think, under 3 years. So really, really, really significant growth. And they mostly did it from one YouTube video. They found someone who's funny and they hired a funny guy on Craigslist. They wrote a funny script and he just talks about it. And it works because he's looking right at the camera. He's doing the sales pitch. It's a classical sales pitch, but it's dressed up as entertainment. It's dressed up as comedy. It still does all of the things that an American expects from a sales pitch. It answers the objections. It talks to the value propositions. It speaks to why you should do this now. It adds social proof. It adds testimonials. All of that stuff. But it's like entertaining, funny, and importantly is like one person looking directly at the camera and saying like, this is what you should do. And it just works.
And engagement, again, so I was talking to my sort of design guys the other day talking about Stakem, which is this the engagement they're getting from their Twitter account. And this has been going on for a couple of years. Just because what they're doing is they're actively and intelligently engaging people in a humorous way. So so the question I really wanted to ask was that as a native Australian, you know, obviously I'm from the UK, moved over here. The one thing that I noticed compared to the UK was that the US was very much and is very much a relationship-driven economy, as far as I could see. And obviously my contacts were, you know, limited, but it's still... I wouldn't say old-fashioned, but it really was mano a mano to a certain extent. So despite all the technology and all of the distancing that that brings, it always boiled down to, do I like this person? Do I trust this person? Do I want to do business with them? And is that something that you detected, moved over here from Montreal?
Yeah, I don't think I realized the significance of it until even this year. I think I really just building an agency, I started to notice how much of it is relationships, and almost all of it is relationships. And an agency is particularly interesting in that context because it's literally just people. It's your relationships with your clients and your relationships with your staff and matching those and ensuring that they continue to be aligned. So you just spend all your time building relationships, just every single second. So I noticed that now I wasn't as, I agree, I think in Australians are a little bit more reserved and a little bit more like less exuberant as people, I would say. And so there is less of that relationship building. And I think Americans also like here, the business culture is very like over the top, I want to say. I think an Australian, even just the way that we make advertising, I think that character of speaking directly to the camera, being like, hey guys, you should totally buy this. I don't think that would fly in Australia. Australians don't like to be sold to as much. But here people are willing to explicitly be sold to.
Yes. And again, are there any other, I suppose, sort of cultural differences that you detected that you can use to your advantage? In other words, having that sort of secret knowledge, whether it be with the businesses that you've run before, is there something that really stood out or astounded you in terms of, you know, the culture or the that part of?
Yeah, I do. I think it's really the blatantness and the explicitness of your ability to sell, and how to an Australian it feels like you have to be kind of comically straightforward to make a sale in America. And it's funny, I was actually talking to an Australian brand the other day, a quite successful Australian brand, who have not been able to make Facebook ads work in America. They spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. They have offices all around the world and they haven't cracked it yet. And I looked in the ads library, I looked at what they're running, and it's like, it's never going to work here. It's just not, it will not fly. And it's because Australians just can't. And I think British people to some extent as well, like, it's hard to wrap your head around how direct you can be.
I found that it is, you know, it's much easier in some respects because you can be explicit, you can be direct, you can deliver a clear message. And I think in, you know, both UK and Australia to a certain extent, you've got to be a little bit more reserved. You're seen as a little outré or a little brash or a little unpolished if you're getting straight to the point. You know, we like to dance around our handbags a little bit more, I think.
Absolutely. And British advertising and Australian advertising, it's much quippier. Like if you read a Subway ad, right? Like if you imagine a Subway ad for like crisps or something, like in the UK, like I immediately in my head see like some funny slogan, some like witty thing, like a joke. And you look at it and you're like, ha, ha, ha. But here it'll be just like, eat it up.
Good point. Eat these crisps. They taste good.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah. Where do I get them? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's very simple. And I think I like that. You know, it's relaxing. It's clear.
But it is. And you can build on that. So that again, that continues to be refreshing and it feeds the sort of the cultural muscles, as it were, you know, but, I'm going to shift gears slightly here, actually, because I think the time has arrived in this Hooked on Startups podcast to ask you my 10 questions, which I stole from someone. And I was just trying to think of that Australian comedian, Dame Edna Everage. Did you ever?
Of course.
I just heard myself going into this deep Dame Edna Everage. I even imagine I had the sort of glasses on. Now, this is going to mean nothing to probably 93% of the people listening to this, but, you know, Dame Edna Everage, Barry Humphries, God rest your soul, what a perfect individual you were, brought joy and humor to millions. That wasn't a question. This is my first question. So, Tim Keane, fasten your safety belt, literally and figuratively.
I could do it right now.
Question number one, what is your favorite word?
God, I don't know if I have a favorite. I mean, what have I been using recently? I've been using high level. If you want a CEO to pay attention and they're falling asleep in a meeting, you just say whatever you're going to say, but you say the word, you say the phrase high level at the front of it.
Oh, you got my immediate attention.
They'll immediately, oh, they're like, oh yeah, okay, that's for me. I'm the high level. That's right. I wouldn't say it's my favorite of all time. It's a very embarrassing kind of business word, but it's a useful
great word and great advice at the same time. Question number two, what is your least favorite word?
High level.
Yes.
There are a few business terms I can't stand when people say download. Let's get the download. For me, that feels like I have become the computer or been made the machine. There's a lot of that kind of business talk that makes me into a computer. And I don't want to know about it.
Fascinating. Question number three. What are you most excited about right now?
I mean, we've got some cool new accounts that I think will work very well. And the business is starting to congeal. So running an agency is a real roller coaster, but every time the thing comes down, it starts coming up again. So I'm like, oh yeah, it's coming up again. Here we go again.
Okay. And I know this, I'm just smiling because I know that journey. Question number four, what turns you off right now?
Facebook, dealing with Facebook and dealing with data stuff and the day-to-day changes in how the mechanics of doing my job are, it's a big buzzkill.
It's a bit like, there's this great book, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. And the world is about to be bulldozed by these Vogon spaceships. And over the loud hailer, it says, we posted this notice 700 years ago, you know, in the basement of planet Tharg or something. So it's a bit like that when you're dealing with these big companies like Facebook and it's like, yes, well, we told you about this change in paragraph 3, section 9 of, you know, the following link. So I know what you mean with that. Everything changes. You only find out about it afterwards. But anyway, wittering on here. Question number 5. What sound or noise do you love?
Ooh, it's a great question. Really, really good question. I love
it wasn't mine.
Popcorn popping. Oh, I enjoy that. It's a great sound. It's nice to know there's popcorn on its way. Let's go with that.
And question number 6, to follow on. What sound or noise do you hate?
I really, really hate like nails chalkboard sound. Like I really, really despise it. I know it's a cliche, but even thinking about it, it's too much.
No, I know. It does. Yeah. you can weaponize that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Question number 7, and you may plead the 5th if you wish. What is your favorite curse word?
Oh, I mean, can I swear now?
Yes, you can. You have full permission. No one's listening.
I'm Australian. I swear constantly. So, I mean, I say all the time. Actually, I did a poll on LinkedIn a while back about whether people swear in front of their clients. And for me, that's when you know that your client relationship is going to go well, when they swear in front of you.
Or very badly.
Okay, or very badly. Or very, very badly. But yes. I'm used to it being punctuation. I have to kind of check myself a little bit.
Yeah, I know. I'd sort of, you know, because, I mean, fucking is this fucking... It's the equivalent of or isn't it?
Yeah.
And 4 weddings and a funeral, you know, fuckity, fuckity, fuck, with Hugh Grant. Just, you know, fantastic use of the word fuck in the most inventive way. But I'm glad you said that. So question number 8, what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. I always wanted to be a film composer or like write music for film and television, which is, I think I could probably still do that. I think that'd be fun.
Because you have a strong musical background as well, which we haven't even gone anywhere near. So
yeah. Yeah, it's definitely not off the table. It's something that I have thought about doing.
Well, you're in the right place, you know, Los Angeles.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Question number 9, what profession would you not like to attempt?
I couldn't do anything like accounting or that kind of, I couldn't be an accountant. I can grow top line and then the rest of it is just like murky mystery to me. Like, I just know I don't have that level of detail.
It is magic. It is a black art, honestly.
Yeah, I'm grateful for an accountant, yes. But it's not me.
My final question then, Tim, If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Oh, wow. Come on in.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. You're late.
Yeah, you made it.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Somehow you escaped.
Final question. How do people find out about you and what you're doing with Loop Club and, you know, all of this huge expertise that you have, and how do they take advantage of it?
So our website is loop.club, and you can check us out there. And I'm also on LinkedIn, linkedin.com/in/Tim-Keen, K-E-E-N. And then, yeah, find me there.
So, fantastic. Thank you once again. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on. There's tons of really useful information, and you know, it's been a delight. And thank you once again.
Likewise. Thank you so much.